Blog Talk Radio.
On Friday, February the 8th, day number 39 in 2013. You know, sometimes they warn you that sometimes your fingers can be too fast. I almost disconnected us from the network about 2 minutes ago. I hit the wrong button. I disconnected us, but I had time to get us back on the air. So here we are on Friday. What a scary moment about 2 minutes ago. I didn't know what had happened, and all of a sudden I disappeared. But anyway, my fingers were fast, and I was able to redial, and here we are with our Friday show, and we're going to be chatting as we do with Fridays with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe, who's going to be joining us today. Of course, she's an author, an economist, and my favorite economist, because she's the one who can explain to me all the difficult issues of the economy, and we're going to get into a little bit of that today. We're going to do our weekly update on Obamacare, which is turning into a weekly surprise. I mean, every week there's something about Obamacare that we didn't contemplate the week before. And, of course, one of the big issues of Obamacare is going to be how Obamacare and immigration reform are going to work together. That's going to be one of the challenges, I suppose, for the people who are putting together the Obamacare legislation, or the not the Obamacare legislation, but the immigration reform legislation, the package that will be eventually going before Congress, if it ever gets there. I'm not totally sold that this is going to happen. I think it's more of a 50-50 deal, because there are so many difficulties in putting together an immigration reform, particularly when you're running deficits. And, anyway, we'll get into that with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe here in a minute. I want to say that there's apparently a snowstorm in the Northeast. That's what we've been watching on TV. So if you're listening to us up in the Northeast, well, I hope you you don't run out of electricity, because there's a lot of snow falling in the Northeast today. My thanks to the management of Blog Talk Radio for sponsoring our program today, or featuring our program today. It's always a great treat when they do that, because we end up on the front page and we get a lot of listeners. And this is one of our more popular programs, the one that we do on Friday with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe. Our sponsor for the first segment today is my book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, which is now available in Amazon. We have a website, cubanosinwisconsin.com, and you can click on the show information and see the website. We've had a lot of success, a lot of good reception of the book. We've had some good reviews. And the book, of course, is the story of my family, my mom, my dad, myself, my brother, and my sister coming to the United States. It sort of covers three stages of my life. As I was a kid growing up in Cuba, then the coming of the communism, and how my parents made the decision to leave, and then, of course, the actual trajectory to the United States, and how we ended up in Wisconsin. So it's an interesting, or so they tell me. People tell me that they've enjoyed it. I was at a breakfast today, and several people have read it, and they were telling me how enjoyable the book is. So I appreciate that very much, and we appreciate the fact that many of you are reading it and buying it. Again, it is available in our show information. Just click on Cubanos in Wisconsin, and you can go to the website. You can even get a copy autographed by me. Now, this is a little technique, a little thing that my son came up with. My sons are the experts when it comes to technology, and they came up with this little thing where you can buy the book and I'll sign it, which is a real treat, because I get to sign the books. So anyway, you can pick one of those two. You can order the book directly, or you can get a copy signed by me. We appreciate either one. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and I bet she's battling snowstorms in the Northeast, although you're not technically in the Northeast, but how's the weather in your part of the world?
Well, it's hey, Sylvia, it's quite nice. We had just a little bit of rain, and it's not bad at all. We don't have any snow, thank God.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe joins us on Friday, and she was on the other side of the phone a couple of minutes before we went on the air when I hit the wrong button. You probably thought I had disappeared from the universe, right?
Yeah, you sounded like you were coming from another dimension, a barrel.
Well, I was in the Twilight Zone. That's what happened.
I was in the
Twilight Zone. I was thinking too much about Obamacare that I got into the Twilight Zone. And all of a sudden, I hit the wrong button, and we all got disconnected. And as they say, everything broke loose. But thanks to the magic of technology, we were able to get back and do things the right way. So grateful that technology didn't fail me the second time. But a quick look at on this day in history, 1587, Mary Queen of Scots was beheaded on this day. 1725, Peter the Great died. So I guess this was not a good day for monarchy. 1943, more recently, the American troops secure Guadalcanal in the Pacific. I'm sorry about that. I got something in my throat. Guadalcanal, the big battle of Guadalcanal in the Pacific, one of the turning points of the Pacific War in 1943. That's 70 years ago today. Well, I know you're a big fan of history. And what about Peter the Great of Russia? Any connection to Romania with him?
No, none whatsoever. No, absolutely not.
Well, this was not a good day for monarchy.
No, it wasn't. He left an interesting legacy in Russia, though. He was an interesting monarch, or czar, I should say, because they didn't call them monarchs. They called them czars and czarinas, sort of like the ones we have in the White House today.
Yeah, well, at least those guys back then, everybody knew they were the czar. The ones that we have pretend to be, you know, officials, public officials. But Peter the Great the big one? Or, I mean, with that name, Peter the Great, was he the big one? Or was it, there was another woman, too, who was a czarina who was really big, too, right?
Yeah, he was succeeded by Catherine the Great. So
right, there you go.
He was a czar in 1696. And he had a lot of military, political, and economic and cultural reform. So overall, he was a good monarch.
But let me ask you a question about these monarchs, because did they call themselves the Great? I mean, that's kind of, they don't have any self-esteem problems from what I can tell. I mean, did he say, my name is Peter the Great, or is that something that other people gave him?
Well, I think people, you know, call monarchs different things behind closed doors. So a lot of times to prevent that, monarchs who are not very modest individuals, of course, come up with the monikers. So.
Oh, I see. So Peter the Great.
Right.
And then Catherine the Great. Catherine the Great is the one I was thinking of. She was in power for a long time, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she was, I know, very, very prominent monarch. And, of course, Mary, Queen of Scots. They cut her head off today. That's not a good day for her.
No, and she wasn't entirely guilt-free either.
No, no.
She has killed some people along the way. So people just don't know all the details.
But isn't it unusual? I mean, what struck me, and maybe it's my ignorance more than anything else, but what struck me is that I didn't think they would behead a woman. I mean, I thought maybe women would be spared that kind
well,
of
I think
ending.
I read somewhere a historian said that people have gone to these beheadings too willingly. If they would have protested more, they probably would have been spared, or some of them. But who knows if that's the case. They just went stoically to their deaths. So they said, well, we're not guilty, or, you know, shouted some other slogan, but usually they did not protest the beheading. So that was interesting. But I wanted to say something else about Peter. Peter actually did give himself the title of emperor. So I'm not sure if he came up with the Great, or his subjects call him the Great just to, you know, be politically correct. But he called himself emperor, and he was emperor for about 4 years, and then he passed away.
Well, I would think that when people went in for a favor, they would say, you're Peter the Great, I'm here to ask you for a favor. And he probably thought that was pretty cool.
Who knows?
who knows? But anyway, Peter the Great. Now, just one last thing about the Tsars. They were in St. Petersburg, right? And is that city
right.
named after Peter?
Yes, because he's the one that established the capital.
Now, was he the same? Just one more question. It's fascinating. The last Tsar was Alexander, right? That was the last Tsar before the communist takeover. Alexandria, what was his wife's name? Alexander and anyway, Katerina.
Romanov. The Romanov.
The Romanov. So he,
and they were all executed. I mean, they all died together.
But the Romanov family, if I could put it that way, began with Peter the Great, or was it before?
I think it was before. I'm not 100%. I would have to go back to my history, but I think they existed for longer than that because monarchs, they tended to intermarry. To give you an example, for example, Charles, the current prince of England, is related to Dracula with the original Dracula, Vlad Tepes, which was kind of interesting. This was a recent revelation.
Well, I think some people would understand that connection, especially his mom, probably.
Yeah, no comment there.
Yeah, I think Queen Elizabeth probably did feel a couple of times like her family had too many connections to Dracula. That poor woman has been put through quite a bit on the front pages with her family. But anyway, how is your political? I got to ask you about your book, and then tell me about your political campaigning. Activity, I should say.
Well, my book is still doing quite well. Sometimes it's sandwiched between Al Gore's and Thomas Friedman. Sometimes it's above them. Sometimes it's below. It's still at the bestseller under globalism and environmental policy. My book is UN Agenda 21, Environmental Piracy. And I think it's the easiest to read and the most comprehensive book about Agenda 21, UN Agenda 21, what it is and how it is really all around us. People just don't know it yet. And for $2.99 is the best book out there. You know, skip a cup of coffee. It's a good education.
Right. And, well, Thomas Friedman, he also wrote a book about the environment?
No, he writes books about, you know, like The World is Flat and some other books. And, you know, he's highly liberal.
Right.
And so I'm sandwiched between liberals.
Well, you're sandwiched between Gore and Friedman.
As long as I get the message out there about, the UN trying to control our private property and sovereignty and the way we live and every economic activity possible, that's okay with me.
That's right. And we have a link, by the way, to your book on the show information. If they click on your name, that takes them to your website, and that, of course, directs them to the book. And in the show information, the show link today in Facebook that I put about our program, I put a link to your show as well. So we're giving the listeners a couple of opportunities to get to your book today, which is available in Kindle, right?
Yes, in Kindle and paperback.
And paperback, yeah. So you can get
right.
it anyway. So
and
how about your political
books,
activities?
So,
go ahead.
I'm speaking, of course, around the area, and I have a book signing this month again in the vicinity in D.C., actually. But speaking of your book, I started reading it. Thank you for sending it to me. And I was laughing about you guys being in Wisconsin, probably the only Cubans in such a cold climate, and it reminded me of my trek to Mississippi in 1979. I wrote about it in my autobiography book, Echoes of Communism. But anyway, I was the only Romanian in Mississippi at the time, and people thought that Romania was somewhere in Russia. But the reason I knew I was the only Romanian is that the governor was looking for a translator. They were having a international ballet competition, and they finally found me, and they said, "Oh, thank God, you're the only Romanian in Mississippi." So that was funny. So
well,
you guys were probably the only Cubans in Wisconsin from
well,
a hot
close.
Island to cold, cold climate.
Right. No, that's it. And that was a big part of the title of the book. We weren't the only one. There were actually 14 of us. There was our family, my uncle's family. There was a lady, And in fact, you're kind of beating me to something that I want, because a lot of people have asked me why the title, you know. And there's two reasons for the title, the obvious one that you just stated about Cubans. But the other reason is that one time when we first got there, we used to have these Cuban parties, and, you know, like three families would show up, and my mom and my aunt and the other lady would cook Cuban food, and it was kind of funny. All the adults were on one side talking about Cuba, and all the kids were on the other side of the room talking about the Rolling Stones, you know. So one day, typical generation gap, you know. So one time they were having a party, and we were having a party, and I hear that it's getting very loud from the living room. You know, it's really getting loud. So I go to the kitchen to get a drink, you know, a soft drink, and I hear my mom and my aunt are just having like this hysterical conversation, and they're laughing to tears, and my mom says, if the CIA was looking for the Cubans, they would find all the Cubans in Wisconsin right here. And that's where the title comes from. When I heard my mom say that, I always kept that phrase in my mind, and I always knew that was going to be the title of the book. And so anyway, I've just broken some news here to some of the listeners, because I've gotten several emails from people saying, what about the title? And there's more than just the oddity of having Cubans in Wisconsin. I owe the title to my mother, my free-spirited mother, who said if the CIA was looking for Cubans, they would find all the Cubans in Wisconsin in this house, something like that, she said. And that's where the title's coming from. Well, when you finish reading it, you can tell us what you think of it. But it does have a lot of...
I would love to.
It has a lot of funny parts to it. I was trying to be... You know, I was trying to write a book without getting too serious, if you know what I mean.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, anyway, what about your political activities? Anything new?
Well, I'm other than the book signing, and I'm speaking on UN Agenda 21 this month, it's been pretty tame. I get so many invitations, I get tired of politics because I like to talk about what's happening, but I don't particularly like to participate in political rallies or, you know, schmoozing with famous people. I'm not that way.
Right. Well, we appreciate you talking to me. I mean, that's a good thing on Fridays. But let's talk about, I know you want to have you just wrote an article about immigration, and I want to get to that topic because it ties in to Obamacare. But let me begin with just a couple of quick things. What is this about the state of Virginia coming up with its own currency? You got to fill me in on that.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I spoke to our delegate, Bob Marshall. He's a wonderful American patriotic. And his bill calls for creating a 10-member commission that would determine the need, means, and schedule for establishing a metal-based monetary unit, basically going back to the gold standard before we even had silver coins, of course. And he wants to spend $20,000 to do this study. And interestingly, the bill passed in the House, but I don't think it will pass in the Senate. But it's gaining traction because everybody is scared, and I mean everybody, the states. And there are 11 other states who have made similar moves last year that is involving the gold standard. But I don't think it's going to pass in the Senate. Everybody is worried about this quantitative easing. We've had QE 1, 2, 3, 4, he's considering 4. And so we're going to have these ad infinitum, which is basically printing money out of thin air, sometimes electronically, sometimes actually printing them with the presses. And at some point, inflation is going to hit because there will be too much currency chasing too few goods. And as you know, in the fourth quarter of last year, the GDP had shrunk 0.1%, which may not seem like a whole lot, but it is a tremendous number. And people have tried to explain it different ways, that it had to do with Hurricane Sandy and you know, people not buying a lot of things at Christmas, you know, and some of which are true, and inventories being short, people being afraid to, you know, to order new things. I'm talking about businesses, which some of them are true. But the reality is that the elephant in the room or in the China closet is not being addressed, which is Obamacare. And I cannot imagine how anybody with a brain cell can believe the Democrats who say that spending $2.3 trillion over an extended period of time for Obamacare will not add a dime to the deficit.
Right.
Well, we don't have the money.
Right. No, I know. It is beyond belief how, I mean, at this stage
yes.
of the game, you have to separate the country, and I don't mean to be disrespectful for people who voted for Obama, because, but I just don't know how else to say it. You got to separate the country into fools and realistic people. And if people keep buying into this Obama and what he's promising, I have to say that you're a fool, because it just doesn't add up. The numbers do not add up. I mean, at some point, I mean, this
not
is like being
all.
In an airplane. I mean, imagine being in an airplane and the tower and from below is telling you, if you don't change course, you're going to hit a mountain. But you keep flying the plane. And so, I mean,
well, and he said initially that it was only going to cost, what, $980
right.
billion, dollars, and then they came up with $1.4 trillion. Now it's been revised, I believe, to $2.3 trillion, and it just keeps, you know, oh, we forgot, oh, we just found out that we have to spend another $33 billion, and it just seems so disingenuous.
Right. Well, I just saw this morning, you know, when I was getting ready for the show, and before I pull my little near disaster with by hitting the wrong button, I was looking at the TV. And this lady, I can't think of her name right now, but she's on Fox News quite often. She's a political commentator. I just can't think of her name right now. But she's very talented, Monica Crowley, I think is her name. Monica Crowley. I think that's who it is. I may be wrong, but I think that's who it is. But anyway, she said that according to the CBO, we're going to spend $47 trillion, this is the federal government, over the next 10 years. $47 trillion. Did you hear that figure?
Yeah.
I mean,
and these are unfunded liabilities. That is, they don't exist in an actual budget, and the money does not exist
right.
for them.
But I'm just sitting there saying, you know, what's it going to take for some people to stop drinking the Kool-Aid? I mean, what's it going to take, folks? For some people, you know, to come down from wherever they are and walk on the ground. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. But I think what you're saying about this Virginia dollar, and I'm being facetious, they're not calling it a dollar, I guess. I just made that up. But the idea is that people are afraid that the paper money's not going to be worth anything, right?
Exactly, and it's likely to happen. There are a lot of the world currency system is really on a road to catastrophe, and I'm not the only one saying this. There are lots of economists joining me in this view because the world is already in a currency war. They're trying to keep their currency low, so their exports are appeasing to other nations. At some point, the end game of this is going to collapse the international monetary system. And when that happens, all these powers that be, all these rich men that control the banking system, are going to get together and make a decision that we may not like.
No,
evidence this, China is trying to rush to buy gold. And I saw a headline which made me laugh. It says the Chinese are secretly hoarding gold. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, if they are hoarding gold and we know about it, how is that secret? Anyway, but that's just something funny. Right now, I think they have a lot less gold than we have, if we are to believe our leaders that we do have 8,000 tons for the United States. I think the last time our gold reserves were actually verified were in the early 70s, 73 or 74, when they did an inventory. But so far the Chinese don't have enough, but they're really buying it like crazy. And the current gold price is about $1,675.77 an ounce. And some people predict that it will rise between $3,000 to $7,000 an ounce in the future.
Right. No, that's pretty interesting. But I think there is concern, and rightfully so, concern that the paper money will lose its value because of inflation, and people are worried.
Sure.
I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, the government is spending our money. I mean, they're spending, and the other concern I think a lot of people have, and rightfully so, is the kids' future. You know, what kind of a future are we leaving them? But of course,
Delegate, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say people like you and I are worried about it, but it looks like there's a lot of low-information voters out there that the only thing they care about is whether or not Obama can go on MTV and, you know, what the latest top 10 hip-hop is, because, you know, the support for Obama in certain groups is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Well, Delegate Marshall had made a statement that I really liked, and this is a direct quote. At some point, there's going to be a dollar that breaks the camel's back, and it's true. And, of course, the Democrats, the opposition in the state, said that he's descending into serious la-la land.
Right.
And they said because Virginia has had a AAA bond rating since Moody's gave it the first time in 1938. But the state has been placed on the downgrade watch list three different times. But that has nothing to do with how Virginia is faring. The move is against the dollar, which is the currency of the United States, not what Virginia has been doing economically, which is typical of Democrats. They always cloud the issue with other things, and they never answer questions directly. And if they do, they lie.
Right. No, I know. It's the same thing with Texas. I mean, the Texas economy, the Texas budget, I mean, we're doing okay as a state. We're doing fine. We came through the recession better than most other states. But the problem is it doesn't really matter what you do because you're being impacted by external factors. And in this case, a federal government that doesn't seem to understand that, you know, they're spending too much money. Now, speaking of spending money, the next topic I want to get into is Obamacare, because there's a lot to get into about Obamacare. It seems like every week you and I speak, you know, there's a bunch of new surprises about Obamacare. And, for example, 7 million people are projected to lose their coverage. I guess these are people who have coverage through their employer. Of course, there's this thing of tax mandates and Catholics. That's still a very important problem. The possibility of what a economist calls the Obamacare recession, the impact that it will have on the economy, and then, of course, the Obamacare and immigration reform. So what I like to do is let's take a little break. We'll hear from our sponsor, and then when we come back, we'll devote a good portion of our second segment to Obamacare and the article that you wrote about immigration reform and the cost of Obamacare. Exactly how much is all of this going to cost? So we're going to take a little break, and we're going to listen to an interesting word. This is our friend Aaron Clary, and Aaron has just written a brand new book called Enjoy the Decline. And, I just want you to hear this commercial because it's extremely, extremely interesting. Let's listen to Aaron.
Hey, everybody. This is Aaron Clary, friend of Canto Talk and author of the book Worthless. Look, normally I'm a happy-go-lucky fella, but let me talk about something very serious. Most likely you or someone you know is depressed about the 2012 election and what it means for the future of the country. And when I say depressed, I really mean it. I'm talking clinical depression. It materially affects your happiness, it destroys any hope you have in the future. Heck, I know guys who are borderline suicidal just because they don't seem to have any hope or future in the country. Well, do me, yourself, or any one of your loved ones a favor and buy my new book, Enjoy the Decline. While the Sean Hannitys of the world are singing, "Don't worry, be happy, my American friend," none of what they say does anything to effectively address your genuine and real concerns about our country and your future. Enjoy the Decline does. Now, I'm not saying the book is going to be all roses and wiener dogs. It's not. I call it like it is and don't sugarcoat it one bit. But I explain how to financially, emotionally, mentally, and above all else, practically adjust to the economic and political realities of the U.S. I explain why there is real hope and a future for every freedom-loving American. You only got one life to live on this planet. Don't let Obama and the socialists ruin it for you. Enjoy the Decline instead. You can get Enjoy the Decline on Amazon.com, available in both paperback and Kindle, and trust me, it's worth the money.
this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and that was our good friend Aaron Clary, who's written a new book, Enjoy the Decline, and it's an interesting book, that's all I can tell you, but he deals with a lot of the stuff we were talking about just in the previous segment, some of the difficulties that lie ahead, and you can get the book, again, we have a link on the show information that will take you to his website, Captain Capitalism, and you can see the book is available there. But Aaron always makes us think, and I think he's doing that with his latest book. Just a quick heads up, and then we'll get back to Dr. Ileana Johnson's show, Dr. Ileana Johnson Poe, not Dr. Ileana Johnson's show. I guess it is, but not what I meant to say by that. But anyway, my son, Gabriel is our second son, and he was the one who helped me with this book. He was very helpful in some of the formatting and some of the styling of the book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, that we just published. He's going to be joining me on a special show that we're going to do tomorrow about the book. We're going to talk a little bit about the book, you know, why I wrote it and some of the things that he learned as my son from reading this book. So we're going to be doing that tomorrow, and I hope you listen to that particular program. Let's get back to Dr. Ileana Johnson Poe, and I just said Dr. Ileana Johnson's show. How do you like that?
That's nice. Thank you.
It rhymes, though. It rhymes. Dr. Ileana Johnson Poe and Dr. Ileana Johnson's show. I think it kind of rhymes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You're a poet. Congratulations.
Yes, I'm just going to write a poem right now called Ileana Show, Ileana Poe. It rhymes. So I have a poem if you can rhyme something. But anyway, let's get back into the program. In this segment, I want to talk about Obamacare and immigration and some of the things that are out there. Let's begin with the latest this week, where the big news is that apparently 7 million people are going to find out that they are going to lose their coverage after all, that when President Obama said, if you have insurance right now, you're not going to be impacted, either he was seriously misinformed or not telling the truth. Take your pick, either one. But the bottom line is 7 million people are not going to be protected or covered. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that's kind of sad, because I think initially this bill was explained to the rest of the country as having been necessary because there were around 17 million people without insurance, most of whom were illegal aliens. That's how it was presented in the press, and you can Google it and find it in many sources. So now suddenly, actually 7 million Americans will lose their job-based insurance, and we discussed that last Friday, why that would be, because the new Obamacare, the cheapest plan they have, which is the bronze, will cost $20,000 for a family or of four, or four or five. That's a lot of money, which is way more than it would cost if you bought insurance before this bill passed through your employer. I don't remember paying more than $300 a month premium per family when I was a college professor. So when you compare $3,600 to $20,000, even with serious inflation, which we don't have yet, that's still tremendously expensive.
Yeah, but I think the point is that we were told, and you're exactly right, if we go back to the arguments, you know, the idea of Obamacare was, a lot of it was, look, we have these people who don't have coverage, and we want to bring them in so that they, you know, so that we're not providing, you know, free coverage in the hospital and all of that, but if you have insurance, you don't have to worry about it. Nothing's going to happen to you. Well, that's not true. I mean, either, as I said, either he was totally misinformed when he made that speech, and I think he said that at the State of the Union, or he said that in a special speech that he gave. I mean, he was either totally misinformed or not telling the truth. I mean, what else could it be?
Well, I don't know, but I do know that the cost that was estimated when the bill was sold to the public was predicated on ending the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, none of which has turned out to be true. And to make matters worse, the military is already $16 billion in the hole so far, And come March 1st, if they don't get the continuing resolution and the debt ceiling increased, they will be in a lot of hurt, because just bringing the troops back from Afghanistan, it was estimated, I read it in one of the sources, it would cost about $16 billion plus, because it's a landlocked country, so it's a lot more expensive to bring troops home and all the equipment and whatnot. So if you add that to the $16 billion, they're already in the hole since October 1st, they already have a shortage of $32 billion. So I don't know what's going to happen if they come to an impasse in this debt ceiling and they have to furlough people. But getting back to the health care, yes, so now you are having 7 million people and probably more who will lose their employer-based insurance coverage, because it's already a lot more expensive, and they will probably opt out to pay the annual IRS penalty.
Now, these 7 million people that they're talking about in this article, these are people who have private sector, or as you say, employer-provided insurance, right, who all of a sudden are going to find out that their employer cannot do it anymore, right?
It's too expensive. The private insurance companies have had to adjust their premiums because they now offer insurance to all 26 years old, whether they're in college or not, and they also have to accept all people with previous issues.
Right.
That before were not covered.
Another thing that came out, and we talked about this last week, was the mandates, you know, particularly for some of the Catholic, organizations or institutions or hospitals or even Catholic schools that provide health insurance. And they made some concessions, at least publicly they did, but now we have many Catholic leaders saying that they weren't really concessions at all, that they were just nothing really improved. That we still have the same issue forcing Catholics, in this case it would be like Catholic hospitals or schools or even a company owned by this gentleman, Hobby Lobby or whatever, who are Catholics. So really nothing improved. It was just cosmetic what the administration did.
Yeah, cosmetic dressing, because they only offered exemptions to churches, association of churches, and a religious order. It did not cover hospitals or somebody like the gentleman who has a Hobby Lobby. So it's just kind of window dressing. But the other issue is, and I call those conscientious objectors, but the other issue is illegal immigrants who are eligible for Obamacare. Under the U.S. Census Bureau, their population survey, they estimate that half of the eligible illegal immigrants would be eligible for Medicaid, and the other half would be covered under subsidized exchange benefits. And who's going to pay those? Because they're not required to pay. After all, they're illegals. And that's going to cost, some estimates say, between $120 and $200 billion in the first decade. But if the law, as it is written, caps total spending on exchange subsidies, because they may change their minds again, it could be as much as $210 billion to $300 billion over the next 10 years. And if you remember, there was also a CBO estimate that in order to fund this over the next 10 years, he's taking $719 billion from Medicare. So their services would be greatly reduced. And on top of that, the benefits would be cut about $1,100 annually for the average American who receives a subsidized benefit through the exchanges.
Yeah.
And we, you and I, will be paying for all these people who, you know, can't afford to pay or are illegal but do receive medical treatment under Obamacare.
Right now, some people have said, and in fact, this week I had a debate with a lady who was telling me that that Senator Rubio's plan very clearly says that Obamacare will not apply to people who are not citizens. So if some of these individuals...
That's not true.
Well, no, but I just wanted to... I'm just going to present the argument.
That is not true. But, well, even currently, are you telling me that people who are here illegally and go to a hospital for treatment, they will be denied treatment?
Well,
this is my point.
This is my point that
I
was telling
they
this
cannot
lady.
Be...
Right. They cannot be denied.
It's against the law.
That's right. If you show up in a hospital, they have to treat you. And then after they treat you, then they sit down with you and try to figure out how you're going to pay it. And then that's when, I mean, for example, I have personal
and
experience.
And oftentimes they don't pay it. They just walk away.
That's
and a
right.
lot of them, if you go to the hospital in my vicinity, I don't even want to go to the emergency room because it's full of illegal immigrants who use the emergency room for sniffles when their kids get sick or they get the flu or whatever. And I don't want to deny medical care to anybody. They're human beings just like you and me. They just happen to be citizens of another country. And not far from the hospital is the consulate at least two countries. I won't say names because I don't want to be called a racist. But and they tell them how to benefit from all the welfare system and free medical care in our country. And furthermore, the immigration services, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, are currently updating their welcome materials for new immigrants to include information about the president's signature health care law, telling them how to benefit from all of
That's
this.
Right.
So the government itself is helping them to be part and take advantage of
right.
Obamacare.
And in the article that I wrote this week, I have a link to the Obama administration doing exactly that, telling people about Obamacare. But this is the reason, to get back to immigration for a second, this is the reason why I think it's going to be very difficult to get a bill through Congress. Because when they actually, all we have right now is sort of an understanding of generalities, you know, everybody. But when they actually get down to the details, I think there's going to be two deal breakers that will kill this thing. Number one, path to citizenship versus path to legalization. I oppose any path to citizenship. I will not support any plan that has a path to citizenship. Path to legalization I can live with in certain arrangements. But path to citizenship I will not accept. I think that citizenship is something that means a lot to you and me who are naturalized. And the idea that somebody should get to become a citizen who came into the country illegally, I simply cannot swallow that. So that's one of the deal breakers that I think will stop this. And the other one, and perhaps more relevant to the budget problems and all of that, is the cost. Because what when they say to me, well, you have to be a citizen to benefit from Obamacare, fine. Then where are these people going to go? Are they going to buy private policies? They don't have them now. So the assumption I think a lot of these people have is that as soon as they become legalized, they're going to immediately qualify for Obamacare. So this is the other deal breaker that I believe will keep Obamacare or immigration reform from getting out of the Congress, because I bet there's a lot of Democrats who aren't crazy about the cost of adding another 10 or 11 million people to the plan. So I don't know. It just seems to me that either Senator Rubio is a bit naive or he's going to hit the wall here, because somebody has to pay for these people.
Well, I don't think Democrats are so much concerned about who is going to pay and what, because they love to spend money, other people's money. So on that premise, it will pass. I just don't know in what form. What bothers me is, first of all, we don't know. The Census Bureau makes estimates of how many illegals are in this country, and they range from 7 to 11 million to 12 million, depending on which source you get, what time of the month. But in 2011, we had 1.1 million aliens who became U.S. legal permanent residents, meaning that they got visas and they were accepted and they have a green card. And 65% of those were done on the basis of family ties, 13% were done on employment basis, 16% because they were either refugees or asylum seekers, and 5% were diversity migrants, which is a category established by liberals, by the way, as if we're not diverse enough. We are. And the
diversity migrants?
Yes, diversity migrants.
You mean somebody
migrants.
Actually came up with that term?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
It's unbelievable.
So
yeah,
what is, I don't mean to make fun. I mean, I'm not trying to get off the topic, but what is a diversity? I mean, I don't know.
A diversity migrant is somebody brought from another country that is of a different skin color and of a different religious persuasion or ethnicity.
Okay, because I was under the impression that that was your sexual orientation category.
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen that, but it could be. Who knows?
No, because
I don't know about that.
Because I mean, again, not to get off the topic, but there has been some conversation about granting asylum to people on the basis of sexual orientation. Anyway, back to the topic. So,
well, anyway, I wanted to make the point that 1.1 million people, all aliens, were granted permanent residence in 2011. We don't have data for 2012. And the top five countries were Mexico, China, India, Philippines, and Dominican Republic. And most of these were from the ranks of, or at least more than half, from the ranks of temporary aliens that were here for different reasons. But there were other 4.5 million visas also approved for legal permanent residents, and they were family-based petitions, but they are pending. In other words, the people can't be legal residents because there are numerical limits in the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952. And so here you have 4.5 million people who have visas but have not been approved, and these are adult children of U.S. citizens who have been waiting for 7 years. And I found a quote in the immigration office that they are now, and I mean now in February this year, they're considering relatives from Philippines who filed papers almost 24 years ago.
Wow.
So you tell me, why should someone who jumped the fence or, you know, crossed the desert or however horrible that is, or swam across the border illegally, should be placed ahead of the queue of these 4.5 million people who are still waiting?
Well, this is why I believe, and, you know, that's why I'm not optimistic that something's going to be done. I mean, I've become actually more and more pessimistic. I was at first a little bit optimistic because Senator Rubio, I like Senator Rubio, and I thought his participation would make something, would help make something happen. But the more that I study this, the more that I look at the potential deal breakers, you know, the cost, the legalization versus citizenship, all these things are just going to make it very difficult for a bill. I have a hard time thinking a bill will come out of the House, and I have a very hard time thinking that they will get, the whatever it is in the Senate where they need 60 votes. So I don't see anything happening because I just think this is just too complicated for even some of the reasons you just stated. There are already people in line who are going to say, wait a minute, what about me? You know, I've been waiting 24 years, and I came here legally, and I've been waiting 24 years. I don't see a solution. I really don't.
Well, in my article that I urge everybody to read when it comes out probably sometime today at Canada Free Press, I put the pro and con of comprehensive immigration reform that Congress should tackle. And under comprehensive immigration reform, which I think should be done first, number one, you have to revise the current legal immigration system. To me, that's a major component. Then you have to have increased border security. You have to enforce the immigration laws that are currently on the books, and you know they're not being enforced because the U.S. government is suing states that are trying to enforce the immigration laws. The comprehensive immigration reform should also include reform of temporary worker visas. And you and I have talked about the Bracero program that was very successful, the strong arm program that was initiated in August 1942 and was ended in 1964. It was highly successful with Mexico. The comprehensive immigration reform should also include the option to address finally, the millions of illegal aliens that reside in the country, some of who actually came in legally but overstayed their expired visas. I should make that point. They didn't necessarily cross the border from Mexico or from Canada illegally. And then last but not least, the immigration reform has to increase the number of visas for those waiting already in the line or in the queue, if you wish, these 4.5 million people that, you know, they have the visas approved but are still pending. And, of course, last but not least, we should address the potential of terrorists crossing the border disguised as fleeing from some South America when they're actually terrorists from the Middle East. And we have found Korans in the desert and things like that to prove the point. And then last point that I want to make is that there are opponents to comprehensive immigration reform, and their opposition has 4 points. One is that we should reduce immigration, not increase it, because we have so many Americans out of work already. That we should limit the family-based legal permanent residence to immediate relatives of U.S. citizens, not extended family like we do it now. In some cases, 50 people have come from one legal immigrant. Oh, and the employment-based visa should only include highly skilled workers as opposed to any worker, because we have plenty of workers out of jobs. And to eliminate, last but not least, to eliminate these diversity visas, which I think they have about 55,000 of them a year.
Right. No, those are very good points, and we're going to put a link to that article on the show information. It'll be on your website, I assume.
It should be out sometime today. It's not published yet.
Well, it'll be when people link to your website, they'll be able to see it. Hopefully. Later today or tomorrow, but this is why I don't think this is why I don't think anything's going to happen. Now I would like to see for certain people a path to legalization, certain people who meet certain criteria. But you know, last Saturday I was talking to a gentleman who is here in Dallas who doesn't have papers. He's working right now, has 3 kids, and I was explaining to him. He wanted me to explain to him, you know, what a potential immigration reform would look like, and I said, well, If you would have to have a background check, you would have to pay a fine, you would have to pay back taxes if, you know, let's say you were here and didn't do tax returns, you might have to pay a fine also if you have to admit that you were using fake documents. Anyway, when I told them all of this, and the estimated cost could be anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 in all these fines, he said, I can't afford that. So I have a funny feeling that a lot of people, when they find out how expensive it's going to be, they may just either choose to stay illegal or go home, because it's not going to be cheap to pay for this new plan. That's my conversation with this guy, and he's a real case. I mean, he's not some theoretical case. He's a real case.
Well, I think they're going to waive the fees, though. That's my case. Oh. It is very expensive, as you know, to become a citizen or even a permanent resident. And I remember when I was a college student, and sometimes I had to weigh, can I afford the gas to drive to Memphis to see the immigration officer, or do I remain a non-citizen? It was very expensive. I only made like $6,000 a year.
Well, I can tell you this right now. If there is no fee or no fine or whatever, or no cost, then the amnesty people have a good case, and then we're back to the same thing. So that's why I'm saying, and we can talk more about immigration next week, because we're kind of running out of time today, but the more that I look at this immigration reform or solution, the more that I see deal breakers, and the more that I see problems, and the more difficult I think it'll be to get to a solution, because it seems like every time you open a door, there's a problem. I mean, the Democrats want a quick path to citizenship. That's not going to fly. The Republicans want guest worker visas. The Democrats have always been opposed to that because of the labor unions. It just seems to me that the more the more you open cabinets or doors, whatever analogy you want to use, the more problems you have.
It is a Pandora's box, especially with those who have been here a long time and their children are American citizens. What do? You throw the parents out of the country and the children remain here because they're American citizens. We have to change the law in that regards, because that law of automatic citizenship when you're born on U.S. soil was actually written when we had slaves, and they wanted to make sure that the slaves' children would be American citizens. We wanted to protect them, the liberals have kind of extended it to any kind of illegal immigrant. That's why they have birth tourism.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. That 14th Amendment had nothing to do with illegal immigrants. It was again driven by the slavery, because you had to give citizenship to people who had not been citizens before. So they said if you were born here, that'll grant you citizenship. But no, I just see this as a problem that is only going to get more complicated, because the more they get into the details, the more complicated it will be. So that's why I'm not optimistic that there's going to be any kind of a resolution. But with that thought, we'll finish today, and we'll pick it up again. We'll pick it up again next week, because I have a funny feeling.
Pardon? Maybe we'll have time to talk about the Texas curriculum indoctrinating
yes,
children.
Yes,
next
I wanted
time,
to get into that today.
That was
but,
outrageous.
Yeah, that was outrageous, and parents here in Texas are pretty angry about that. But next week we'll get into that. We'll get into that, because that's a very complicated subject, and a lot of parents, rightfully so, are very angry here in Dallas. Well, that's going to do it for today, Dr. Eliana Johnson Poe. I hope everybody reads your book. And keep having a lot of success. Anytime you're in company with Al Gore and Tom Friedman, at least that's good company, at least when it comes to selling books.
I would leave it just at that.
That's right. It's not good company to go to lunch with, but it's good company when it comes to selling books.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. Until next time.
All right, until the next time. Dr. Eliana Johnson Poe, and we have a link to her website on the show information. Click on that and get yourself a copy of that book, UN Agenda 21. I think you're going to like it. Going to like it a great deal. Well, that's going to do it for today, folks. Everybody have a wonderful day. It's a beautiful day in Dallas. I mean, an absolutely beautiful day here in the Dallas area, and I plan to go out this afternoon and enjoy this day as soon as we finish with the program. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll talk to you later.